Hi there. Welcome to Sample Space, a podcast hosted by Probable, where we try to discuss tools and techniques that might go overlooked in the world of machine learning. This week, we're going to talk about the Marimo project, which is a project that represents a notebook-like environment that really tries to do something different than what Jupyter is currently doing. In particular, I'll be talking to one of the founders of the project, Akshay Agrawal, and we talk about not just what it's like to be able to reimagine a tool, but we also talk about how inspiration can sometimes come from surprising and different angles. Akshay hasn't just been building Marimo, he was also involved in TensorFlow and CVXPy, so he's got a pretty solid technical background as well. It's a really interesting conversation, and I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I have. Great. So, Akshay, hi, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Vincent, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. I know you from the Marimo project, and we're going to get to that in a bit, because I think Marimo is doing interesting stuff. But as always, I'm always interested in what led to the creation of something like this. And we did a call beforehand, and during that call, we also learned something interesting, that we both went to the same junior high school. Turns out it's kind of a funny small world, so like smack dab in the middle of Silicon Valley. And that led you to Stanford, and a bunch of interesting stuff started to happen when you went to Stanford. And I would kind of like to start there, because that's a nice introduction to Marimo, I think. So if you would, like at some point after high school, you went to Stanford. How did that lead to Marimo? Just kind of a lightweight question.
Sure. Let's see. The road to there, it took a while because I joined Stanford for my undergrad in 2012, and Marimo was started actually exactly 10 years later.
Okay. we can shorten the decade a bit, but yes, it is a decade. It's a fair observation.
Yeah. I can definitely shorten the decade. So at Stanford, I did my undergrad there, and then I came back for a PhD. During my undergrad, I was really interested in computer systems and also math. And I guess if you're interested in computer systems and math, I was doing a computer science major at Stanford. At least you naturally did machine learning at that time. You know, 2012, you know, there was the ImageNet sort of challenge that was big. TensorFlow came out sort of somewhere in that window from 2012 to 2016. So I was doing computer systems and machine learning during my undergrad. And during the summers, I was doing internships at Google, where I was working on a bunch of actually very systems-y projects, like Linux kernel testing, flash drive performance, garbage collection and performance, et cetera, things like that.
So one quick question about that. So, I mean, I did a lot of college in the Netherlands, and doing an internship at Google would not be like a normal thing, but there is a stereotype that stuff like that is more normal in Stanford. Is that something you can confirm, or is it kind of a it depends story still?
It's definitely pretty normal at Stanford, yeah. They had, I think they may have stopped doing this. They even had like, so my freshman year internship I did there, they had like a special program for freshman interns, which was different from the regular interns. And they had easier interviews for freshmen. And I think they probably looked at, you know, some select schools. So at least all the freshman interns I met were Stanford, Berkeley, Penn, these kinds of things.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. So, no, fair enough. So Silicon Valley is an interesting place with that in mind. But Stanford is also definitely an interesting place. Like it's a well-known school and all that. But okay, you did your internship at Google. Kind of the low-level stuff is what I'm also hearing. That was the thing that you were into back then.
Yeah, definitely, 100%. I like thinking about systems. They have a certain mathematical nature to them. And so that's sort of what I focused on during those internships and my undergrad years. But I minored in math, and I took all the machine learning classes. So then after graduating in 2016, I took my first full-time job. And this was surprise at Google after doing all these internships. But it was different from the work that I did previously. So I actually joined the Google Brain team as a software engineer on TensorFlow. And so this was a fun time because it was when TensorFlow was transitioning from TensorFlow 1 to TensorFlow 2.
Would that be 2017-ish?
Exactly, yeah. I think October or September of 2017 is when I joined. So I was on the TensorFlow 2 team before we had yet released TensorFlow. Released TensorFlow 2. And spent a lot of time there thinking about data flow graphs, which are integral to Marimo. I was a software engineer on the library. I was there for a year.
And kind of, again, I got to ask, like, because TensorFlow to me sounds like a super, like, big, ambitious project. And was it like intimidating to work on that fresh out of college, or were you already exposed to it? Like, what was that like?
You know, it wasn't that intimidating. I don't know if it's just like being young and naive or something, but like, I think like that. So I was exposed to the concepts already of like what it is to build, you know, systems level software. I used TensorFlow the quarter before in my CS2 and natural language class.
And I can also imagine, again, because if you're surrounded by like super clever people all the time at a place like Stanford, and then also, and if you add to that, you already did a pretty sizable internship at Google, right? And you've already been using the library. So it wasn't like you didn't get your feet wet before at all in that sense.
But I think the biggest thing actually was that, like, so I joined this TensorFlow 2 team, and like, yeah, TensorFlow was really big, but TensorFlow 2 was like a small team of, I don't know, maybe five or six people when I joined within the larger TensorFlow team, which was, I don't know, probably like, I don't know, many dozens of people.
Right. So it was like a small effort initially when you were sort of joining in that sense.
And these people, like my manager, Asim Shankar and the other folks I worked with, like so kind and like so supportive. And like, I could just ask them like really dumb questions and they would take the time to whiteboard with me. Like folks outside the TensorFlow 2 team as well, just basically anyone in Brain was like, there was a very good mentorship culture there. So it's very welcoming to new grads.
Yeah, I can imagine. And it's also kind of like a nice era to be there, I can imagine as well.
Yeah, I think that was kind of like the golden age of Google Brain, where like,
no pandemic, no big LLM craze or anything like that, right?
Yeah. So like on the research side, you know, the researchers, you know, really it felt like at least did whatever they wanted. And they worked on lots of cool projects. And on the software side, there was also like a lot of trust of like,
you know, And sometimes you also need a bit of patience. And for that, you also need trust. Sometimes that's kind of required. That's true. What's interesting at this point in time, I think at least, is, I mean, you're kind of there in terms of the golden path, right? Like you do your Stanford thing, you're at Google, life is good. Like that's kind of the story that a lot of people would like to tell.
So
life was good. And I guess you were there for like a year or so before you moved on to the next thing. But what made you do the next thing? Because again, like on paper, the paper would say stay, like in theory, right? But that's not what you did.
Yeah. It's a great question. And you're right. Like it was a fantastic place to be at that time. And I love my team. I think, so the reason I left, and I left to go back to Stanford to do a PhD, was I really liked research. And not just any kind of research. Like I know people would ask like, well, why don't you stay at Google Brain and do research? You know?
It sounds kind of researchy, right? Google Brain, right. TensorFlow, right? It's not completely devoid of it.
Some research, I heard there's something called attention, maybe.
Yeah, something.
Yeah. I didn't want to do, at least at the time, I didn't really want to do what was like sort of mainstream sort of neural network type research. I think it's extremely, you know, obviously it's borne a lot of fruit, but like intellectually, I didn't find it as interesting. And I really wanted to work on like sort of more close to like the foundations of machine learning.
And what about it? So it sounds a bit like boredom, but was that because it's all gradient descent? Is that kind of the thing that kind of made it feel lazy intellectually or?
I mean, I think, yeah, exactly.
Right.
So my PhD was in like convex optimization and its applications to machine learning. And there, I think like the problems that you work with and the optimization algorithms like exploit like a lot of structure that is like very interesting mathematically, as opposed to, you know, when you're, you know, working on neural network research, like the optimization algorithm is totally besides the point. You know, you just SGD your way down to a local or maybe global minima. And like the engineering application, I think, is a lot more interesting.
And also to maybe clarify to some of the listeners, you've mentioned convex optimization. Like, I think that would be the slightly more theoretical side of some operations research kinds of departments, right? Like, it's kind of in that field. Would that be correct characterization?
Yeah, something like that. Like, I think, like, in operations research, they often deal with, like, you can tell me because I think you have experience, but, like, integer variable problems and you have, like, supply chain type things.
For traveling salesman variants, that sort of thing, that definitely comes. But I will say, like, the convex stuff definitely does make an appearance. But my, for the listeners, like I did operations research as my master's. Convex optimization is a bit more like a tool. Like there is an assumption that there are solvers for it.
Yes.
But then there are certain specific problems for which you might need to tweak the solver. But there is an assumption that for convex problems, we have a solver. That's kind of.
Yeah. So I think that is the great, a really good distinction. So I was sort of on the tool side of that, like thinking about like both like modeling problems as convex optimization problems in software, and then also using convex optimization algorithms as a tool to solve other problems. So like for my PhD thesis, I was working on like vector embeddings. And I think you had Leland UMAP, right?
So UMAP fame, yep.
Yeah, he was actually one of the reviewers for my PhD thesis for my monograph, which was on vector embeddings.
Yeah, he was on this podcast like four episodes ago, small. Yeah.
And by the way, his notes on my thesis were, they were amazing. Like I was so great. My thesis was like over 100 pages long, and I didn't think anyone read it, but he read it, and I was.
He's an amazing character. He's an amazing character. I do want to make one observation though. Like the world is big, but our world also feels small at times, because it does feel like in our little ecosystem, there's a few people that end up maybe building something or doing something, and via whatever weird reason, there are all these links in the sense. So it's like this whole programming thing. To some extent, it's also like a weird social phenomenon. It's like one thing I'm just also observing here. I don't know if you agree to that, but...
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think like open source probably helps with that a lot, right? Because...
Totally, yeah.
That's, I think, a big way that those links and bridges are made.
Yeah. And also there's this weird thing with conferences. That's also something I keep on learning. Conferences are these weird moments where people actually meet, and that's also the moment where sometimes some of the weird magic happens.
Yeah.
Just having
and it's funny, because like you think like, well, at a conference... there's way fewer people than there are at the internet. So, but somehow it's like when you have the people who are doing the thing, you know, all meeting together. Yeah, I think some kind of magic happens.
It's funny you mentioned that. So during COVID, I made a bit of a hobby of, I mean, hobby's not the right word, but I really missed the hallway track at conferences. And I organized PyData Amsterdam. I've done a few of these conferences. So I was like very aware mentally, like, oh man, I missed this. And that's when I noticed on Twitter, what I could just do is go up to someone and say like, hey, I think we appreciate each other's work. Hey, stranger, shall we just have a virtual coffee and like hang out for an hour? And I totally survived COVID because of that, I think. Like that, there was something social about still being able to meet strangers. And that's also how I met Leland, actually, just random on Twitter, kind of. Okay. But about your PhD, because there's something, because we have too many interesting sidetracks. So one thing that I thought was particularly interesting here is like one of my operations research books was like written from like the folks over at Stanford. But while you were there, you were also one of the core contributors of this little library called CVXPy, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And how much of your PhD was maintaining CVXPy? Because I can imagine by being exposed to that library, you also gain a renewed appreciation of like, oh, these are problems that people are having, and that can like very positively influence like the direction of your PhD. But at the same time, I can also imagine like maintaining that thing's no small feat, because it's a pretty popular library, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very popular now. It's like over 1 million downloads a month on PyPy, at least. Maintaining specifically?
And also for listeners, like CVXPy, if you haven't explored it already, I explored it in a live stream a while ago. If you're doing convex optimization, so quadratic programming or stuff like that, it is a really nice library. Like,
yeah,
straightforward, integrates with NumPy. It's neat.
The way we describe it is that I think we say CVXPy lets you write your optimization problems in a way that follows the math
and Python at the same time. Like it's that combo that makes it so neat. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we compile it to the really dense or sparse numerical format required by solvers. Actually not that much time was spent on maintenance burdens. Like the maintenance burden wasn't too high. And I think part of the reason is that like we did have a solid group of contributors. It grew over the course of the PhD. So Stephen Diamond was the original creator of CVXPy. I joined him, I don't know, a couple years into the project. And then more maintainers joined us. Someone from Caltech just was procrastinating on his thesis.
As one does in a PhD.
Yeah. Which, by the way, is how we have one of our sort of our biggest Marimo contributors is currently procrastinating on his thesis.
But we'll one does during a PhD, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's something that actually Trevor said in your podcast with him. I was listening to it about like keeping the API surface small intentionally. There's something we did with CVXPy. I think also helped reduce the maintenance burden. Because like the way that CVSPy works is like there's one rule. Your problems have to be written according to this grammar. And if it is, we can compile your problem down and solve it. And so the surface area to interact with the solvers was small.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't there for the very beginning of the work. I'm sure in the very beginning when Stephen first created the library and it was adopted by all these classes, I'm sure then the maintenance burden was very high.
And that's because it just got so much usage in one go, exactly. Basically. Yeah.
For me, my relationship with CVXPy was more of like, you know, I joined my PhD. We did like a major rewriting of it to make it closer to like the architecture of software compilers with front ends and back ends. And then like I would do a research project, for example, like figure out how to canonicalize or solve a different class of convex optimization problems or a problem that doesn't look convex. Make it convex, and then implement.
Yeah, so that's the rewriting trick. That's the operations people love to like. It doesn't have a dual.
And then implement that as a small extension to CVXPy. So that was largely my sort of relationship to it in that way. And then we did this crazy thing where we figured out how to differentiate through these problems and put them in PyTorch, so you could learn like the parameters. But that was a whole other thing. So,
Are you still in touch with the CVXPy people? Because you've been on that project for a good 4 years. I can also imagine after a while, it's good to start something new, but it can also be kind of hard to say goodbye, especially if it's
I'm still in touch with them. I'm good friends with them.
Right.
So Stephen Diamond is, you know, he lives close to me. His company is a Marimo user. They started using Marimo before it was open source. They were one of our early sort of alpha testers.
There you go.
We're good friends still.
I want to promise to the listeners, we are actually going to get to Marimo at some point, but there's one question I'm kind of curious about with your opinion on CVXPy. So again, like my background is in operations research. So I'm taught to think not just in traveling salesman problem, but the thing that I really learned was you want to optimize something, like minimize what cost usually, but you have to really think about your constraints. So minimize costs, but the constraints don't match reality. Like, that's not the way you do this work, buddy. That's not the way this works. But I was taught, like, hey, these constraints really matter, because otherwise the application to real life is just going to be bopkis. And then I entered machine learning, and in that realm, we are minimizing, kind of what you mentioned with the, oh, it's boring because the only thing we're doing is gradient descent downward, but there's no constraints. Yeah. And you've got like some pockets, right? Like there's a good bias mitigation sort of pocket in machine learning, and they actually really think about constraints that relate to fairness, so to say. But it's always been a little bit mysterious to me that way of operations research thinking, that's a bit unnatural in machine learning for some reason. I'm kind of curious if you've got a perspective on that, because it feels like you want to have algorithms work in reality. So why aren't these constraints more mainstream, I wonder?
Yeah, I think it like has to do with also like the applications of like where the constraints are used. So like, for example, like I think one great application of convex optimization, or, you know, the problem is actually non-convex, but you solve it with a series of convex ones, are like engineering design problems. So like I have a friend who, you heard of the Hyperloop, like a
vacuum tube thing can go fast.
Yeah. So, you know, he was using convex optimization or form of it, you know, to design a Hyperloop, right? And so there, like, you have all these engineering constraints of like, well, what is a Hyperloop system? What are the laws of physics, et cetera, et cetera? And then you had to find parameters to construct your physical design. And your design has to be, if your constraints are violated, you just can't really build the thing. Like, it doesn't make
sense. It'll implode or something, yeah.
But like in machine learning, I mean, the goal is, you know, quote, simple, predict this thing. Just, you know, fit some parameters to predict something and minimize a loss. So it's more of a prediction problem rather than like a control or a design problem.
Yeah, and there's no physics that give you I think having physics that inform you about the constraints that exist, that really helps.
Yeah, or like, you know, in other applications, like if you're using optimization to make trades, like financial trades, like you may have certain constraints. You have a budget that you can't, you know.
Yeah, and a risk preference, hopefully.
Exactly, yeah.
No, that's true. Okay, no, that I guess that also makes sense. And it's also like operations research has a lot of these like mechanical engineering applications, actually. That's also true.
But I do want to say that with the constraints, though, like if you know about the framework of optimization and how to solve problems that have constraints, you can do cool things in sort of unsupervised learning or machine learning. So like from my thesis where we worked on like a generalization of vector embeddings, like we can fit like UMAP style embeddings, but that also have constraints in like a principled and like really fast way. Cause like we can use, you know, basic techniques from optimization. So like we can fit embeddings that are constrained to be standardized. So like, you know, XX transpose equals the identity. So they're all well scaled and stuff. We can anchor certain points and like leads to faster algorithms and more principled algorithms than just trying to do things with SGD and then project onto your constraint setup.
No, that's true. I mean, what I sometimes worry about is that if I do like to think that if you just are aware of the fact that you can add constraints to a system, it just such a door opens up in terms of creativity. Like you can really rethink the system a bit.
Yeah.
So for example, one thing I loved doing in the live stream was, okay, there's a couple of examples that we get and that influences the loss function. That's great. But then we also have some of these examples and, oh, we got to get these right. Like these examples, they're special citizens. Like if we get any of these special citizens predicted wrong, like that, oh, that's going to go haywire.
Yeah.
Ah, and those data points become constraints instead. Like the fact that you're able to declare that to me sounds like such an intellectual freedom.
Yeah. But, and I think, yeah, there's a literature, and I don't know how much people still talk about it, but I think like Yang LeCun used to talk about this stuff, like energy-based models and like structured predictions where like your prediction is the result of solving an optimization problem, which may have constraints.
Yeah.
And so you can have like actually constraints enforced at inference time in this way. I'm sure these things still have applications, just probably right now not to what everyone is, you know, whatever everyone's Twitter feeds are saturated with, i.e.
And also at this point in the podcast, we've also established why it makes sense that someone like you indeed does a PhD in this field, because people who aren't watching along can't see it, but like obviously we're both enthusiastic about this stuff. Like this is definitely like a fun little background. But again, it's a similar situation, right? So you've done your Google thing, you've done your PhD thing. So all right, fang it up, right? It feels like a natural next step. But what's interesting here is that again, the thing that on paper would have been like the obvious choice didn't happen in this case, because you've done CVXPy, you've done systems programming at Google, so you've got like very solid like experience in your 20s in that sense. So that's nice to have that early. But what happened next?
What happened next? So this was end of 2021, which is when I finished my PhD.
COVID, right? Let's
COVID. That's true. I started in 2018, so there wasn't. But yes, most of it was in quote during COVID. Yeah. What happened next? Well, I had to decide. Well, what do I do next? So I think like, over the course of like working at Google on TensorFlow, then during my PhD, like, yeah, I did a lot of mathy stuff. But to me, the part that I found really gratifying was working on basically open source developer tools for people who work with data, whether that was CVXPy or the embedding stuff. Well, I think it was just exactly that. Like, I found so much gratification from like building tools for other people to go and solve problems. And I felt like with CVXPy, like, there's still active work on it, but I felt like, okay, it's at a really good place. It's a really mature library. It's got tons of users. TensorFlow obviously is already very mature. So I wanted to sort of look for my next project where like, well, what is the next thing where like what I can work on that that I think would really empower a whole different class of folks who like to work with data.
And was it that they were interested in doing something new personally as well? Or were you also sort of looking for something that you could call your own? Was that maybe also something of a motivation there?
I think both.
Right.
I like being... So I think the thing is like when you start something from the beginning, and what I really liked about my PhD is that when you start something from the beginning, you have the opportunity to totally rethink something. And that's the part that I really enjoy, like rethinking a system from first principles. And so if I were to go and join something, unless I found something that was already super new, you know, you probably don't have that opportunity to do it as much. Yeah, so I was looking for something new to work on. I knew that I wanted to build tools for folks who work with data, to make it easier, better, you know, whatever, to make the experience with working with data much nicer, I guess. Mm-hmm. It sounds banal. And so then I looked at, you know, I thought about, like, well, what tools are very widely used and, like, instrumental for working with data, but maybe have assumptions that maybe should be questioned, or, you know, otherwise have a surface area to be improved. you know, I thought back to my PhD, and like one tool that me and my colleagues used almost every day was, you know, the Python notebook, Jupyter notebooks. Jupyter notebooks are great, right? They let you hold, like, they let you interact with your data while you work on it. Like, it's in RAM, you can manipulate it, write some code, see how your data changes, etc. Jam on. But I think like anyone who has worked with notebooks also know that they have like a lot of problems. You know, your colleagues will hand you a notebook and they'll be like, okay, here's my work. It's done. And you're like, okay. So for example, maybe they hand you a notebook that implements like a chapter in a paper, like an example, right? Then you go and you run that notebook and you just see tons of errors, right? And why do you see errors? Like, one, you don't know what packages they use and they didn't document it. Two, they ran a bunch of cells in some arbitrary order without like restarting and running all. And so, and then a bunch of cells are commented out and you're like, okay, wait, maybe they ran that cell, then commented it out, then ran the next cell. And so just all these problems, like, so it felt to me that there had to be a better way for us to work with data in an interactive way, in a way that was more reproducible. And that felt like more like working with real software as opposed to like doing some kind of scratch pad work.
How much of this do you think is, because I've had this conversation with folks in industry as well. And like sometimes there's complaints about the notebook. And some of that, I wonder, could also be that when you're in college, the notebook is also kind of like your safe place. Like, oh, it runs in the notebook, so I'll just stick to that and not learn anything about the command line or Git or any of those things. And you can kind of see how that attitude of, oh, this is safe, I'm not going to do anything else, can also lead to bad coding practices. Like, was that part of it maybe? Or was it something else that you think about, like the Jupyter design that was kind of like your eyesore?
So there's, I think, fundamental issues with traditional notebooks, not just that, you know, you learn bad habits while using them. And, you know, in principle, Jupyter could grow out of this, but at least the way that Jupyter is today, right? Like, so for example, I think the biggest problem is hidden state. And this is like a problem that's like endemic to notebooks that is not the fault of the user. But like, for example, you have a cell that declares some variable called X, right? And now the rest of your notebook uses this variable X. And you decide for whatever reason to delete the cell that declared the variable X. But the variable X is still in your notebook's memory because your notebook is essentially just like a REPL where like you run a cell and it mutates a global workspace that's hidden behind that you can't really see. So the rest of your notebook is still referencing the variable X, you're doing computations with it, but then the next time you come and run your notebook, someone else runs it or you restart from scratch, the whole thing's broken. And like you can lose like a whole day's worth of work or more. I mean, this happened to me. It happens to many folks.
If you accidentally delete a cell, command Z can only go so far.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And like, it may not even be accidental. Like you deleted a cell, but you didn't realize that, oh, you actually declared, that cell declared a variable that you needed in downstream cells. Like you can throw a bunch of stuff into a cell.
Yeah, so like deleting a cell is not the same as a conscious like calling del in Python and then the variable name. Those are two different acts. And there's a disconnect there is kind of your observation.
And like if you go, or even if you're not deleting, you just go and you edit a cell somewhere in your notebook. If your notebook is super expensive, like you're doing some super duper embedding or web crawling or training or neural network. So you don't want to hit restart and run all. So now you have to know, okay, I edited this one cell. There's some other cells that are using the variables that, you know, the cell that I edited is using. And now I have to go and manually run the minimal set of cells in order to keep my notebook up to date, I think is like a huge cognitive burden for the user. And like, it's too hard to do reliably. Like imagine if you're in Excel and like nothing ever auto-calculated, like ever. And then you would have to go, okay, in my huge grid of cells, which ones do I need to refresh now that I've changed my data? And that's kind of an extreme example, but I think the point still stands.
Yeah, that's a funny analogy, actually, Excel. Because Excel is like the DAG in a way.
Yeah.
Okay, no, so that makes sense. Like the thing, in my mind, there are sane ways of dealing with a notebook, but it does always feel like it's a mind shift. Like you can treat a notebook as a notebook, as a scratch pad, so to say.
Yeah.
And you have to be just mindful when you start doing more serious stuff with it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where some disconnects can happen if you're not careful.
I wanted to build a tool where you didn't have to take extra steps to be mindful, but like this kind of reproducibility and just like a good experience was like built in. And so that was sort of my motivation. And I had a ton of inspiration, which I'm happy to talk about too.
So I'm just kind of wondering, like I remember the announcement of Jupiter. I don't know if you saw that, but the thing that was so memorable about it is the whole announcement was made in a lightning talk.
Okay.
So which I thought was like the most sort of flex move you could pull in open source land. Like, by the way, the IPython shell thing. Yeah, we're going to do Julia and Python and R, and it's going to be called Jupiter. And here's a quick demo. But like, if you think about where it came from, right? They were trying to improve the IPython experience thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's sort of a natural transition from IPython to the web. But in IPython, you don't have because that's an actual REPL, there's no notion of cells anymore. It's just a long history in that sense. So the interesting thing is a translation got made in order to get it to the web. And we can now sort of look back and wonder, well, maybe a different translation might be more useful. That's sort of your perspective then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think like fundamentally what makes Marimo a lot more, I think, interesting, or, you know, complementary at least to Jupiter and IPython, is that it's not just a REPL, but, you know, it's actually, I kind of think of it as like a reinvention of the Python notebook as like a reproducible, interactive and shareable Python program. Like, each notebook is actually a program that has like a well-defined execution order and like doesn't have hidden state.
So this might be a good moment in time to go a little bit in the technical details there. I'm kind of wondering what might be the best place to start. And I guess like a good place, at least that's the first thing that I noticed when I was playing around with Marimo. It's not a JSON file. It's a Python file. Like that I think was like, there's a pretty fundamental difference. And I think a lot of it's actually code philosophy comes down to that. So Marimo is doing something to a Python file that's different. Like, how would you describe that maybe? Because it is just a Python file, but Marimo does make a couple of assumptions, I suppose.
Yeah, it's Python, not JSON. That is one huge difference between Marimo notebooks and Jupyter notebooks. So I guess the way that it works in Marimo is that, like Jupyter, you start a Marimo notebook from the command line. You type, in our case, Marimo edit, which opens a notebook in your browser. And
you would run Marimo edit and then like a file name, right?
Exactly. Marimo edit file name, or Marimo edit without a file name to get like a directory. But let's say you do Marimo edit file name. Now you have a tab open in your browser, and you'll see a cell, like similar like you will in Jupyter, where you can type in Python code. And you can create multiple cells, and to create your notebook, you basically build your program out of multiple cells. But the way that it's different from Jupyter is that what Marimo is doing behind the scenes is that it's building a data flow graph. You know, I think it comes all back to TensorFlow in some sense, but it's, you know, it's in a way that is invisible to the user mostly. It's creating a data flow graph on your cells based on variable declarations and references. So if one cell reads a variable X and the other cell uses a variable X, Marimo knows that those two cells have a dependency. And that fact, this graph, is what we use in order to ensure that your code on the page and the outputs you see are consistent. And the way that translates, I guess, into the Python file real quickly is that instead of storing your notebook as this like blob of JSON, each cell is stored as a function that maps its references, the variables it depends upon, to its definitions, the variables that it creates. And then we use, you know, standard Python syntax. So we use decorators to roll these functions up into this notebook or app object. But that I think users can kind of view as an implementation detail. But the benefit of the pure Python file is that, one, it's very readable, so you can actually version it with Git. Like, we designed it such that a small change to your notebook is guaranteed to yield a small Git diff. So there's some nice locality there. And then also, we've set it up so that you can actually execute your notebook as a script, which I've noticed is like something that a lot of folks want to do, even back in sort of when using Jupyter notebooks, you know, they'll make pipelines and stuff out of notebooks, but it's kind of clunky. With Marimo, you can literally do, you know, at the command line, Python notebook.py --, pass in some CLI args, and boom, you're running it as a script.
The thing that I always try to avoid is, I think if you're a mature team, you can get Jupyter notebooks to work. Like, I always want to be a little bit careful in joining some sort of a cargo culting thing, right? People are allowed to have preferences, but I'm pretty sure if you're a mature engineering team, you're going to be able to figure it out. Something about that feels kind of mature. But you are right in the sense that it does feel more natural to run a Python file, because you just run Python as you would normally. Like, you don't need to have an extra tool on top of the other tool in order to get the thing to run as you would normally. Just for clarification, perhaps. So in the end, each cell has code in it, and in the Python file, that'll go into a function and that's decorated. But then there is still a distinction between a line of code in a cell and another cell. But I believe the order is a single cell is sort of a computational unit. So that entire cell will always run. If there's a dependency, the entire cell will always run. It's not like a single line will ever be run. But the variables that you declare, they do determine how the cells are kind of hooked up in their DAG form, so to say. So
yeah.
The variables determine the edges, but the nodes are always the cells.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Good. Okay. That's the impression I got. I'm happy to hear that it's accurate. So it makes sense that someone from like the TensorFlow 2 team is thinking about these DAGs and computational directions and all of that. But what are the main benefits that you, when you designed this, what are the main benefits that you expected to have? And are there any benefits that you didn't necessarily expect, but that you did see once it was implemented?
Yeah, that's a great question. There definitely are new benefits. But so the ones that we expected to have. I think the core pillar of Marimo is that, you know, the notebook is organized as a DAG. And from there, we get a bunch of benefits to the user. So one is elimination of hidden state. And so my biggest inspiration for this one was actually Pluto.jl, which is a notebook for the Julia programming language. A lot of people in Julia prefer Pluto over Jupyter now.
I have to mention here, like, if you haven't seen it already, the guy who does 3 Blue 1 Brown, I forget his name, Grant Sanderson. He has one Pluto demo that is the bee's knees, the one where he shrinks the image.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, it is a really cool demo and well worth your time. Like, to the extent that I would argue, feel free to pause this podcast if you haven't seen it yet, because it will help explain what follows next. Is that there's something interesting that Pluto does in that video? Like, how would you describe it? What Pluto does differently than Jupyter?
So I guess what Pluto does differently than Jupyter, and by extension Marimo, because we've based a lot of Marimo's design was based on some of Pluto's original design. The biggest thing is that in Pluto and in Marimo, because your notebook is organized as a DAG, we actually have a special runtime to run your notebooks. So when you execute a cell in Pluto or Marimo, the notebook will know what cells depend on it, and it'll automatically execute the dependent cells, keeping their outputs totally up to date. And Marimo, we recognize that this can be a little tricky if you're working with a really expensive notebook. So we actually have an option to just like mark your cells as stale instead of auto running them. But this reactivity also extends to UI elements. And I think that's where some of the magic starts to happen. I don't remember the exact example that you're mentioning for Grant's example for Pluto, but basically in both Pluto and Marimo, these notebooks come packaged with UI elements, and they're from the simple ones to like sliders and
top downs,
but also like webcams and like filterable tables. And we have, calling back to Trevor, I guess, again, like what Trevor mentioned about this like bidirectional communication.
Trevor from AnyWidget, by the way.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
What he mentioned is that, so in these notebooks, if you interact with the slider, or text field, these inputs, their values are automatically sent back to Python, and then the Python cells that depend on these values automatically run, making your it really brings your notebook to life in a way that is very hard to do using.
Because I guess the implementation really is, the slider updates, therefore the cell has updated, therefore propagate. That's I think just
exactly.
the basic situation of it, right?
It's a small extension to the reactivity. Yeah.
Right. Now, so in Jupyter, there are these IPython widgets, and they are neat, right? They do offer like a lot of value to the Jupyter ecosystem, but they got added on later. And I think in your case, this was kind of more of a primary citizen.
Exactly. Designed from the beginning.
Yeah.
And I guess to your question then, like what are the benefits that the organizing as a graph gets you? So one of them is the elimination of hidden state, or at least keeping your code and outputs consistent. Like You delete a cell, Marimo will delete its variables from memory and invalidate all the other cells that reference.
Yeah, there's going to be some red on your display there if you're going to delete that.
You can make the runtime lazy, so then it'll mark the affected cells as still. But yes, they'll either be red or a bunch of yellow.
Warnings. Yeah, exactly. Like the more dangerous colors will appear magically.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So that's one. So it keeps your code and outputs consistent. The other is this interactivity, which we just touched upon. So like, because we have your notebook as a DAG and because we can run these cells reactively, you know, we know how all the data flows through all the descendants of a cell. Now, like using widgets there's no callbacks ever required. You know, you just scrub a slider and then boom, everything is sort of magically updating on the fly. So this enables a third thing, which Jupyter doesn't have, except you can do it with things like Voila. The third thing that this enables in Marimo is that every Marimo notebook can be run as a simple web app, right? Kind of like Streamlit. So you can do Marimo edit mynotebook.py to just work as if it was just a notebook. Or you can do Marimo run mynotebook.py and it'll serve your notebook as a read-only data app, you know, code hidden by default. And because we have a DAG, you know, whenever the same sort of reactivity that you would see when you're editing a notebook with UI elements applies to the web app. And you actually get better performance than you do with Streamlit, which is not something that I guess we knew sort of subconsciously when we were designing Marimo. But it was something that a lot of sort of Streamlit users came to us and said, oh, wow, like one reason I really like Marimo is that it doesn't rerun my whole notebook from top to bottom.
So I was about to say, like, that's probably the reason then. It's not going to rerun the whole thing. I think in Streamlit, there are systems that you can do such that there's a full stop somewhere and it doesn't rerun the entire thing.
Yeah. And there's caching, too, that you can opt into.
But it's definitely not as lazy. You need the DAG in order to be properly lazy, and Streamlit doesn't sort of have that built in. That's definitely an observation. Yeah, so I was actually impressed by that. The funniest thing was that the week before I tried Marimo the first time, I was actually talking to someone like, oh man, I wonder what it would be like if you had cells in Jupyter and you could sort of drag the output of the cells around as if it was like a dashboard. Like, oh man, I think that'd be neat. And then within the first 5 minutes, I just learned it's one of the features in Marimo. That was good. And it was really great because I was not looking forward to sort of implementing anything like that myself for Jupyter. Like that would have been a whole lot of work. Like you do think differently about cells if the output of them can just be thrown onto a canvas and mix and matched as well. Like that was the main thing that I did not expect.
Yeah.
And it was a really nice surprise.
And I think what you're getting at also is because we have the DAG, actually the order of the cells on the page is not what determines the execution order. Right? Like you can mix and match, put cells wherever you like. It's the DAG that determines what is going to execute and when. And just like in Excel, right? Like you can have a bunch of cells in a 2D thing.
I kind of wonder, so in JavaScript land, there is this thing called observable. Mike Bostock and friends from the D3 project, they ended up doing that. And one thing I've noticed they also have a similar thing. But what you then notice is that then all the declaration, like the stuff you do in the beginning, like you declare all the variables, that always happens at the bottom of these observable notebooks. Like a thing that's sort of evolved naturally.
Yeah.
Is that also something you like? Is there also like a different culture in that sense with these Marimo notebooks? Because I noticed that the cell output in the base default behavior is on top as well in Marimo. That's are there like little weird things that you've noticed in the community that, hey, because Marimo works differently, like the output document and the way to interact with it is also like super different from Jupyter?
Yeah, I think it's like an aesthetic that's like evolved in this family of reactive notebooks. So there's observable for JavaScript, Pluto for Julia, and now Python for Marimo.
Marimo over for Python, yeah.
Other way around. Yeah. So I think Observable started some of these precedents with the outputs on top. Pluto followed, and I fell in love with Pluto when I saw it. And, you know, Pluto describes, Fonz, the creator of Pluto, describes it, your code is a caption for your output, which to me makes a lot of sense. And so that's the default we chose as well. We did get a lot of pushback from some users, so now it's configurable. You can make the output come up below. In terms of the imports or the declarations going at the bottom of the notebook, I think that it just somehow feels nice. I mean, you're free to do whatever you like, but it's I think again the analogy is those are appendices that you don't need to necessarily see when you open up a notebook, especially if it's designed for like an to read. I think like every person and team will have their own sort of practice, and I'm sure we'll develop like linters too, and then we can have an optional lint rule. Don't do things out of order or something for people who don't like.
Yeah, that makes sense. No, that's but it is a different experience, I would say. Like, you are forced to rethink a few things is one thing. Yes. I've noticed. And that is definitely different.
One thing I think you're sort of forced to rethink is basically like, for your code to work well in Marimo, it works best if it's written in a pretty functional way without like mutating state or lists and things like that.
State becomes a mental, like you have to be, it becomes a more of a conscious thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that leads to better code, but that is something that you definitely have to learn.
Yeah. So, I mean, people have to stop with in place is true in pandas anyway, but
exactly.
The stuff in Polars, like my claim to fame is that I'm such an early Polars user. I was actually the guy that ended up implementing the dot pipe. inside of Polar, I really love that way of working with data frames. Like, take this function, Polar then data frame into function, then into function, into function, and super stateless. It's the best.
I want to answer your question about things that we didn't expect. Of, you know, what are some benefits of a DAG that sort of surprised us? But one thing on Polar is I am waiting for Polars to come to WebAssembly or to PyDide, because that would be amazing. If you have any sway with them still, please put in. I'm sure they're very busy, but
I cannot confirm or deny anything. But we might have some of them on the podcast. I think it is sort of on their roadmap, though. Like I cannot confirm or deny, sure. The issue with Polars is that they have so many ambitions. Like, they want to do proper GPU support, and you know, and there's a need for that. But you do touch upon something else that's interesting, like the whole PyDide stuff, because that is a thing you folks support pretty well, I think. And it is also a new thing in notebook land in general. This whole thing of like, hey, via this weird thing called Rust, then WebAssembly, we can now do Python stuff in the browser, which is kind of an arc a lot of us didn't expect to ever work. But we're kind of getting there. And that's also something that you folks are sort of keen on working. Like, what's your perspective on that whole domain? Because I can imagine you're eager for that future as well. But it's, you're also so cool. a little bit closer to some of the challenges, I reckon, as well.
Yeah, no, it's so cool. For the folks who don't know, PyDide is, I guess, a distribution of Python that web browsers can execute natively, right? So using an instruction set called WebAssembly, so it's been compiled down to WebAssembly. But the point is that, like, your browser can run Python code. Like, you don't necessarily have to now go hit a backend.
There's no server here. And from the perspective of, let's say, the scikit-learn documentation, the thing that is always a little bit nervous is that, a user gets to write Python code and then it runs on our server in order to show you the matplotlib thing. And something about running other people's untrusted code at random from all sorts of internet strangers just doesn't sound appealing. No. But if we can have that in kind of a nice container in the front end, then imagine how interactive documentation could be. Yeah. That's a future we're really looking forward to.
Yeah. And so we have that. And so for PyDide, I think what it really excited us, and it continues to excite us. So what we did is, so Marimo's backend, its kernel, I guess, if you will, is totally implemented in Python. And so we looked at PyDide and we realized, like, our entire kernel is basically compatible with PyDide and can just run directly in the browser. And we also noticed that, like, a ton of popular packages for Python, basically every pure Python project, but in addition, some.
Yeah, so not everyone. You got to be a little bit careful with that one. I think these days NumPy and scikit-learn are good, but stuff like Polars, for example, there's like a few of these that need to be rebuilt in a specific way in order for them to.
Yeah. But even DuckDB works today. There's a lot of packages that do work. So we spent, you know, a couple weeks designing an implementation of Marimo that can run entirely in the browser, and we have it today. You can go to marimo.new or to open like a blank Marimo notebook in your browser, and it's a playground and it's just running directly.
And I think also, if you have your own notebook locally, you have to go to the upper right hand corner, click a button, then click another one. Like, there's a little menu.
Exactly.
You got to find the menu, but once you find it, you can export it and then run it on the Marimo main
In the playground, yeah.
Yeah, the playground environment. But that's one that's hosted, I think, on your side at the moment, right?
That is currently hosted, yeah.
Yeah.
The playground actually runs in WebAssembly still.
Sure. But it's not like you can. But it's no like run locally thing for this yet, I think. But was that a moment where you looked in the mirror and thought, "Huh, I wonder if it worked," and it turned out to be a very easy switch to flip, or was it a little bit more involved to get it just right?
So I think there was just getting like the Python code to just work in the browser. That just kind of worked out of the box. But to get the full sort of Marimo experience,
there's tons of small little UI details, and
UI, but also like lower level things, like getting interrupts to work so that you can like interrupt a cell was not entirely obvious. The PyDide folks actually had documented that pretty well. You had to use like some array buffer
workers.
And there was a lot of front end work, some sophisticated stuff that a co-maintainer Miles was working on, like file system support. Like he made it so that you can do like os.write and it'll write to your local storage in your browser. So there were definitely challenges there. But for the most part, I mean, the PyDide team has done an amazing job.
And it's genuinely moving the ball in the right direction on that front.
I think the biggest limitation with PyDide right now, it's not even PyDide, WebAssembly, and probably will hopefully over time sort of be lifted, is I think they build such that the total addressable RAM is just 2 gigabytes because the size of their pointers is small. But I think that is a technical limitation that I am optimistic as more people adopt.
So there's another interesting thing that I just kind of observe here. So during my interview with Trevor Mance, I think I mentioned that I sometimes talk to people who are building a data science product, let's say, and usually the warning that I give is be careful because you're never going to be able to out notebook a notebook. Like if a developer can do stuff in a notebook, being able to do the exact same thing in a third-party product is not necessarily going to be an awesome experience. But what you folks have been doing here is you've not been sort of out-notebooking a notebook, you've just been designing a new one. why try to out-notebook a notebook when you can just rethink the whole thing? But in doing so, you're also not a user of a notebook anymore, you're a designer of a notebook. And that is really rare. Like it's not every day that you get to design the tool that is all tools in a way, because that is the fundamental thing about the notebook. It is such a flexible sort of whiteboard or canvas, if you will. So I know a lot of painters who love to paint on a white canvas, but this is painting on a canvas that you yourself can also design in a way. In sort of not necessarily what you learned from the users, but like something that made you appreciate the idea of a notebook. Was there anything unexpected that happened there while you were sort of designing and building this?
Can you unpack that a little bit more?
Yeah, sorry, I've been going on a small rant there. No, so like you mentioned a few lessons that you only were able to learn because you exposed yourself to it. So things like the interrupt. Oh, there's like gigabytes here that we got to sort of keep in mind. And by diving into this little rabbit hole, you do expose yourself to a couple of like interesting problems that normal people like me just don't face because we just assume there's a notebook there. Like what's been the most challenging thing about making Marimo, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I see.
And I agree. This was a long question. I could have kept it shorter. Sorry.
No. It's a fantastic question. I mean, there's a couple of things that have been challenging.
Because I can imagine some of the challenge might be like the social part. Like people are just used to Jupyter. How do you get people off Jupyter? Like that's like a thing, I suppose, right? But I don't know if it's the thing.
Yeah, no, I don't think the migration is the thing. Like you mentioned, that's a social problem and also somewhat of a technical one. Like we have like an auto converter from Jupyter to Marimo that now works pretty well. I think like the hardest thing, I don't know if it's unique to notebooks, and maybe we'll get there as we talk through this, but you mentioned notebooks are powerful because it is like one tool in which you can do all kinds of work, right? You can do scratchpad work, you can do data engineering, you can do research, you can train models, you can do whatever, right? You can program, you have some...
The brain fart can be really elaborate in that environment, yes.
Right? So you can do so much. So Marimo imposes some constraints, though, on how your notebook can be written, right? Like I mentioned, like it should be sort of functional in some way. You can't redefine variables. So I think the hardest part is coming up with that contract between the notebook or the library and the user of like, hey, this is like what you need to know about how to write a Marimo notebook. Like, these are the three rules that Marimo has. One is, I can actually say it, but coming up with the rules that Marimo has was the hardest part, and making sure that those rules were like one, they weren't too imposing of constraints that people are like, nah, I can't use this. But so they were flexible enough to still allow people to do a whole ton of things in notebooks while also still nailing down like notebook reproducibility, eliminating hidden state, allowing for this reactivity. So like crystallizing those rules at the outset, I think was the challenging thing. And so like you can, if you're like really nerdy and really bored, like I have this repo, it's public, of like a Marimo team / MEPS, Marimo Enhancement Proposals, or just me writing it for myself, very long documents about like designing like one, just like each of the, like designing like one of these rules, like what is the reactivity rule? What is the UI element interaction rule? What does the file format look like? And these things, like I think ideally they're designed so that the user doesn't think about them that much. To me, designing these rules and so that the user can easily understand them and still be empowered to do a lot, even more than they can do, hopefully, in traditional notebooks. I think that was the hardest thing.
The thing that makes me giggle at this point is because it does feel like we've really come full circle, because basically what I'm hearing is, yeah, like once you know the constraints from the perspective of someone who did operations research, right? Then it's easy, but finding the right constraints, that's the hard bit.
Actually, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay, I did not expect this full circle, but I am really enjoying it. This is such a nerdy thing in a way, but yeah, this is actually kind of, makes a lot of sense.
And then from there, I think, then some of the harder things. I think once you have those constraints nailed down, it makes it easier to like, explain to users why your notebook is a certain way, why these constraints exist. Because people would come to us in our Discord and say, hey, please introduce a mode that lets me just use this like Jupyter, so there's no DAG and I can just run random cells. And like they're like, that will make it easier for me to switch. And okay, maybe it would, but also then you don't get any of the benefits
about
Marimo, right? Like you can no longer run it as an app, you no longer have UI on. I had this interaction in Discord recently. Like someone like first came in, they're like, this doesn't make sense. Like, why do you have like, you know, I'm not happy with these, you know, constraints. It's very difficult. And then I wrote like a small paragraph and they're like, thank you so much. It makes so much sense. And
yeah. Like, can acknowledge that there was a half hour of like unlearning or like being aware of the fact like, hey, there's a habit that's grown into me now that it's kind of like getting one of these like ergonomic mechanical keyboards. Like your shortcuts are away in your fingers. The way that you think about starting a project or a cell is like a lot of these little things are different. But I also think that because it's so different, it can also sort of be its own thing. That's also kind of the beauty of it. It doesn't necessarily have to be compared all the time with Jupyter. It can also just be that Jupyter is Jupyter and Marimo is Marimo, and they're both kind of different. And you can pick and choose when you use either of them. But the point here is that there's a nice difference.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. If we tried to be Jupyter too, you know, if we tried to encompass it, I think we would fall over from our bloating.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also nice to be opinionated and different. That's also helpful, I think, in some sense. Yeah.
Quickly, I was just going to mention a couple things just because they're new.
Yeah, go ahead. I have the time. Go ahead.
Okay. What folks might like about unanticipated benefits of having a DAG at the center of the notebook. There are a couple of cases where we had some like sort of complicated technical problems that we were solving that like were made a lot easier because of the DAG. One is kind of circular. We wanted to make it easier to convert Jupyter notebooks to Marimo notebooks.
Mm-hmm.
But because Marimo has constraints, such as, you know, you can't like redefine variables.
Right. You can't do everything there, I suppose. Yeah. There's a limit. Yeah.
But the conversion tool, actually, we actually made it quite good because we realized that we can just like take Marimo's DAG construction tool, apply it to a Jupyter notebook, and then it can catch like mistakes. And then we can do rewritings along the way. So it became like a compiler pass almost over the Jupyter notebook to turn it into a Marimo notebook.
Okay.
So that was kind of cool. Yeah. And then the other one is a new feature that we just released, an external contributor who is procrastinating on his thesis.
As one does.
Yeah. It's a very cool feature. which is, we call it persistent caching. And I can say it's a very cool feature because I didn't develop it and he did, so I'm not bragging.
You just get to brag about it.
Yeah. So what it does is that, like, you basically, it's a context manager. You put a block of code in it with mo.persistent cache, and then you just have whatever, you know, your cell code underneath it. What's cool is that it like functions kind of like a functools.cache, but not on a function level, on a cell level. And what it does is, the first time you enter the code block, it executes all the code. And then it saves your variables to disk using a variety of different protocols, including Pickle, but also like NumPy protocols for whatever. It saves it to disk. The second time you come and execute that block of code, either in the same notebook session or a different one, it can check whether or not it needs to recompute the cell code or whether it can skip it. And the way that it does this is by, one, looking at like the closed over values in the block, but also looking at like the notebook structure and all the ancestors of the cell and checking if the code of the ancestors has changed.
Does it do a thing where it kind of looks at the string representation of the code and just hashes that? Is that like the thing that's used as like the key for the cache, kind of? Is it kind of like that
mechanism? Yeah. Something like that. It ended up being like pretty big brained. But I think that's I was like, wow, there's a lot.
There's a lot of caching you can do with like a good hash trick like that.
But I think it's really cool because, like, I don't know if you know, you or your listeners play video games, but it kind of feels like you play a video game and, like, imagine you're playing a game and, like, you can't save. You always have to start from the beginning of the level. Like, I think my experience working with expensive notebooks, like during my PhD, if you forgot to, you know, cache an intermediate output or something like that, like, you come back to your notebook, and it took like 12 hours to run, and like the kernel crashed or whatever. And you're gosh. But here, it's like you have a checkpoint that, like, is guaranteed to be valid, like it meant, because we have this sort of the DAG behind the scenes and stuff. And anyway,
It's nice to have something like that inside of Marimo. If people are listening to this and kind of going like, oh man, I'd also love to have this in my Python script, there is a project called Disk Cache that basically does this, like, a very similar thing. But you basically get like a Python dictionary, but it's SQLite under the hood. Oh. So whatever thing goes in, that's kind of like hashed and keyed, and then boom, we pickle the thing, and that goes into SQLite. It's a bit of a dirty trick. You shouldn't really do everything with it, but boy, is it nice to be able to leverage SQLite for some of this stuff as well.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
And there ends my nerdy rant about things that the DAG
enables. Well, I mean, this is kind of like a nice little segue to maybe the conclusion of this, because it does feel like, you know, you've got a Discord that seems to be growing. People like to share GIFs on Twitter or X or whatever it's called these days. Like, it does feel like Marimo is in an interesting place in terms of, like, it has a few things going for it. I think we've not even talked about, like, the auto-completion stuff that you do, or like some of the widgets that have been added that do LLM stuff, right? I mean, it definitely feels like people are sort of still exploring and having a field day with what's possible. So at this point in time, like, my impression is that on paper, you're doing something and you're going to stick to it for a change. But like, what's the situation with Maria right now? Like, what are the things you're looking forward to in the future in that sense? Like, what's sort of happening at the moment?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Marima is a company. So me and Miles Skolnick are the co-founders, and we work on it full-time. Right now, it's just two of us, and it's been around for 2 years. We've been lucky enough to get, like, contract funding through a Stanford National Lab called SLAC, which is what has enabled us to fund ourselves, essentially. I mean, our long-term vision for Marimo, short-term and long-term, is, you know, it sounds cheesy, but, like, to build
Marimo.
Well, like, they're like a really, really great programming environment for working with data, right? Just rethinking what that means. And I think we've solved, like, a lot of the sort of core problems that we originally set out to solve. But I think there's, like, a lot of other really interesting problems that we haven't really looked into still. We've, like, solved the interactive part of working with data. Not solved, but we made progress on it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole other space of, like, getting data into notebooks.
Right, so connecting to databases, maybe something along those lines.
Like, we do have, like, SQL cells. We have some limited support for those right now, and there's some parsing of the DAG. Right now, we only support DuckDB. It would be cool if
SQLite, Postgres. Right?
But also, like, there's this other thing. Shout out to this same contributor who's procrastinating his thesis, has this great idea of like making notebooks. And it's kind of weird, but it's also, I think there's something here because it's very cool. It's like, we have a DAG. Like, can we get data parallelism in these notebooks? Prototype. So I think there's like places we can go for like Marimo is great for like your interactive work. You can use it how you use Jupyter locally. You can,
What if we sort of rethink compute in a notebook
way? Exactly. That's something that at least really excites me. And it's something that I always wanted to work on during my PhD. I didn't really have time. It didn't really fit. Yeah. So that's one direction we're excited by.
Yeah, and it's also a nice observation that you start with a white canvas, you do the whiteboarding thing, and then you at some point you notice, hey, this part of the whiteboard that has a nice pattern into it. That's set. Oh, there's all these other parts of the whiteboard I can still draw on.
Yeah,
kind of that feeling.
I think that's exactly it. And I think these things come in cycles, like you said, or like, you know, you do your whiteboarding a lot. You have a really big white. At this point, actually, it was my apartment. My apartment like 2 years ago, I had a giant like window and there's post-its everywhere. I looked.
Gotcha. Inside. Yeah.
So I think like we're due for another one of those sessions soon. And
the Leland McInnes in his episode also mentioned an interesting sort of. Like, how do you spark creativity? How do you keep that going? Like, one exercise he mentioned was we are going to do, like, a theory sprint. Like, we're going to really look at this in the theory lens. And then once we've done that, we're going to look at the code and really just do the pragmatism thing.
Yeah.
But we're going to be very conscious. We're going to do one thing at a time, not both.
Yeah.
And typically by just trying to force yourself to change perspectives, something about that also allows for new ideas.
Yeah, I think that really resonates with me. Yeah.
I've heard it from a bunch of people, but then, but cool. Then I guess the future we're gonna have to wait and see. But definitely, you're not gonna stop doing interactive stuff, but you are gonna start maybe doing other things that can be rethought of in the notebook. From my perspective, it definitely looks exciting. For me personally, I still enjoy using Jupyter for some of the stuff that I do, but I really like the fact that there's an alternative. Like that's the main thing that kind of excites me. I'm always a little bit worried when something is at risk of becoming too much of a monoculture. So the fact that we're able to rethink there and give ourselves a little bit more of a creative freedom, that's definitely like a win, I would say. Yeah, that's definitely.
I appreciate that. And yeah, I think like just to, I've mentioned it before, but to give credit where credit is due also, like, big shout out to Pluto JL and before them, I guess Mike Bostock and Observable.
Yeah.
Like, huge inspirations for me and seeing like, you know, how widely loved their projects are and used, especially Pluto in the Julia community.
It is the shoulders of giants thing.
And Jupyter. Yeah. I mean, you know, none of this would have happened without Jupyter, right? It's an amazing project.
Jupyter is also not done yet. That's also something I keep remembering. Like I actually forced myself a while ago to do the Jeremy Howard thing, where he really does all of his dev work inside of a Jupyter notebook, and then he sort of has a compile step from notebook to Python. And like from the outset, I always felt it was a bit insane. Like, why would you just sort of do code this way? But one thing that did sort of dawn on me is like sometimes I actually write Jupyter widgets. Like via any widget, I do write some of those things. And then it does feel kind of weird to, oh, I'm going to go into PyCharm and then to see if it works, go back into a interactive environment. And so like one thing that I think will be interesting for Marimo as well is like, what would that look like? Like what it would look like? Like, hey, I'm doing algorithmic work. In order to write my algorithm, I need charts. Can I write Python modules maybe this way?
Oh, interesting.
That's sort of what I'm also wondering, because I was making this thing in PyTorch, like a mixture density network, and then you get the variance that goes out, and then there's a regularization parameter, and I want to see that the chart for the distribution that goes out, I do want to see that the regularization parameter has an effect. And yeah, I can write a unit test, but when I'm debugging, I need that chart. Okay, if I need that chart, why am I not developing in an environment that has that chart? Something about that.
That's a really interesting idea. We have one feature roadmap that maybe gets us closer to there, which is, so I mentioned cells are like decorated in these functions. But we also have a feature roadmap such that if your function is pure,
No it side just, effects like that story, yeah?
It just gets inlined directly into the notebook.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can just use it as a function. You don't have to go through any extra rigmarole to because it's a Python module. You can say from my notebook, import my function and just go mm-hmm. and just use it. And notebooks are written intentionally to be lazy so that you can actually import that as modules and like it doesn't automatically start executing your notebook. So that might be one way to.
Yeah. So that is kind of how the Jeremy Howard thing works. Like you can. There's sort of a build step, but if you make an update in one notebook, you run the build step thing, you can run it automatically. That updates the Python file, then another notebook can sort of benefit from it. So there is, you can also have a relationship between notebooks in Jupyterland in that sense. I guess that's kind of the dream. For some stuff, I really love using a proper IDE, and some of this LLM stuff, you know, there's excitement and all that. But for some of the creative stuff that I do sometimes that's kind of new, I need more peripherals. And that it has to be more than just characters. Like, it has to be something visual, something interactive. And especially if I want to build tools that sort of, oh, here's a data set. Can you explain what's in it? I don't know if words will cut it. Like, it feels like a lot of tools still need to be invented in this machine learning space as well. This is a long conclusion in a way, but...
I agree. That's why, you know, we're all out here inventing and having a good time.
Yeah. Well, it's also a privilege, right? Like, we get to geek out about this sort of thing, and that's it's definitely nice. But super thanks for being on. It's been a somewhat longer talk than usual, but I think we've covered a lot of interesting ground. If people want to find you, I guess, like, one place you're sort of hanging out is your Discord. That's like maybe one of the main places, but you're also on GitHub, I suppose. That's like,
yeah, Discord would be a great way to just chat with me directly. Me, Miles, Dylan Mattacetti, and all our Wasim. We have a bunch of contributors out there.
And there's like a room, I suppose, for like people who are delaying their PhD.
And that's basically the entire Discord.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm kidding. But yeah, Discord's a great place. I am on GitHub. I'm on Twitter too. I think my DMs are open.
Cool. Yeah. Then once again, thanks for being here. People feel free to give Marimo a spin. If you're eager to rethink Jupyter, Marimo might be a place where you can do that. But yeah, thanks for being on.
Of course. Thanks, Vincent. It was a pleasure.